Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today we're going to discuss the topic of salvage, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Ken Carlone, who holds a doctorate in forest ecology and has studied forest ecology in the Umpqua watershed for decades. Welcome, Ken, and can you tell us more about yourself?
Hi, You mentioned that I've been studying fire and forest ecology on the Umpqua for several decades, and that's true. I arrived here on the Umpqua in 1982 as a much younger man, and have always been interested as a person that had already had a master's degree in evolutionary ecology. I began to look around and see the issues associated with the forests here. And so I went back in the 90s and got a PhD at Oregon State University in forest ecology with an emphasis on fire and particularly the use of fire by native people here, indigenous people on the Umpqua, and looked at forest structure as we could reconstruct it from ecological and historical and archaeological data, and then looking at the shift in the change of forest structure because of the change in management from native peoples here to the Euro-Americans that arrived and sort of imposed their European ideas of how forestry should be done on these Western forests. And so the forests, through the work that I've done and much and many others, we see that the forest structure is very different now for really, two big reasons. One is, first of all, fire suppression that we've gotten good at over the last century or so that has changed the dynamics of the major change process that has been going on, the disturbance process, as we call it, that have been going on since the last over the last century, but also the change in how Euro-Americans manage their forests and the sort of structure that our management practices have imposed on the forest.
So if we have listeners that are very new to the field and very new to environmentalism, and we have people who are experts, can you just give us a generic definition of salvage? What are we talking about when we're talking about salvage? To me, it kind of means getting what you can out of what's left over.
Yes, and that's of course how it is used. And the idea is that when there's a major disturbance, and in this case it's fire, that the dead trees out there have a certain amount of economic value, which is of course true. They do. And so the idea is that you want to go in and take those trees within a fairly short period of time, 2 to 3 years, because as those trees stand in the forest, they begin to decay. And so the value of the lumber in those trees decreases over time. So the idea is to get in as quickly as possible and remove those trees from the forest. So the idea with salvage is that you remove those trees as quickly as possible so that you can capture the economic value from them. So that's what we mean when we say salvage.
So when you're talking about capturing the economic value, you're not talking about correcting or fixing or going toward forest health. You're
Correct.
not removing them for the forest, the health of the forest. You're talking
Correct.
about removing them for the economic value.
Yes. And one thing, there's a very, very common misperception that if you leave trees in the forest that have been burned and killed by fire, that you are going to be leaving more fuel in the forest to burn again. And so
Right.
again, it's a common, misconception that not salvaging trees just means that there's going to be more fuel in the forest for a future forest fire. And so that's not true for reasons that we can talk about. And also, typically when people talk about salvage, it's like, okay, you remove the trees, what then? You turn that forest into a plantation, you plant trees 8 by 8 or 10 by 10, and you get these very even aged, very dense stands of of typically conifers, almost all Douglas fir, that gets replanted in those areas. And so if those stands were allowed to regenerate naturally, a number of things would be different compared to replanting a plantation. Ecologists talk about this idea of succession, that if there is a major disturbance, there is a relatively predictable a sequence of events that happen where you have soft body plants, forbs and herbs and grasses and that sort of thing, herbaceous plants come in, and then you have brushy species come in, woody but small, you know, low species. Mm-hmm. And then you might have hardwoods coming in, oaks, madrones, maples, alders, things like that. And then ultimately you have conifer forests that that would come in. And that process would typically take, you know, somewhere between, you know, it would take several decades, 50 wow. years in some circumstances, maybe longer for that process to happen. Whereas after salvage logging, when you're going in and you're planting, every tree is exactly 2 years old that you're planting. And so you have an absolutely even aged forest. You have a pattern that is absolutely stacked tight by, you know, just crown by crown by crown. The trees are all touching each other. And part of the reason to do that is that foresters, production foresters, want those trees to close as quickly as possible. They want those canopies to close because they want to be able to shade out everything that might come in that could compete with the young seedlings, right? And so oftentimes, they will, on private forest land, they'll use herbicides to keep the weeds down. You know, by weeds, you know, we're talking plants that are going to compete with the seedlings. So, you know, grasses in particular, but also a lot of shrubby material that will grow quicker and maybe shade out those seedlings. In a naturally regenerating forest, you're going to have some of that, right? You're going to have seeds that are going to blow in from surrounding forests that are much more likely to be adapted to those microsites, those areas, than seedlings that you would buy at a nursery that are grown by the millions, literally. And so you're going to have a situation where this, you know, you're going to have a little, you know, a couple of seedlings growing over here, and then maybe, you know, you have a brushy patch over here. And as that patch dies back, maybe a couple of other seedlings are going to grow up. And so over a period of time, you're going to wind up, you know, having little individuals and little pockets of seedlings developing all in at different spacings and different ages and different heights. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to get a much less uniform structure. Now, if you're growing a plantation for lumber, that uniform structure is actually something that you want. You want those trees to be closely spaced. And as soon as they begin to crowd each other out, then you go tip, you know, here's the scenario that foresters typically want to follow, claim to follow, and oftentimes don't. And that is, you go in after, you know, in what's called the stem exclusion stage. So when you start getting winners and losers, and you see some crowns are overtopping others, some of those trees are dying, that's when you want to go in and do what's called a pre-commercial thin. So you thin that stand so you spread those trees out so they can grow faster and produce lumber more quickly. You leave all that slash down on the forest. And it only costs you money. You don't make any money on a pre-commercial thin. You're spending money to thin those trees that you planted super tight so that you could crowd out the competing vegetation. Well, now they're crowding each other out.
Right.
So you've got to go and thin them out. And that's called a pre-commercial thin. And then as those trees begin to develop into large enough trees to harvest for lumber, you'll either clear cut at that point, and I'll explain in a minute, you know, how you make that decision, or you go in and do what's called a commercial thin. So you're cutting the trees now that actually can go on log trucks and go to the mill and turn into some sort of lumber, right? And then you come back you know, when those trees now have closed in, the trees that you've left, they're much bigger, much more lumber in them. And then you clear cut and repeat. So you plant 10 by 10. They grow really tight. They crowd out the vegetation down below. As soon as they begin crowding each other out, you do a pre-commercial thin, leave all that slash on the forest floor, and then wait until the trees get big enough that they have some value. You thin them again to take some value out of that stand. And then you wait for those trees to then close back in again, at which point now they're bigger, more valuable. You clear cut and repeat. So that's how modern silviculture works in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay. So the thinning is not salvage. Salvage is something that happens after something else has happened, some kind of storm or fire or whatnot.
Right. And so in a situation where what you're looking at, if you're doing production forestry, is you're looking to get the biggest return the fastest you can, right? And so what you want to do, you don't want to let those trees grow into big, mature, very high grade trees. I mean, you could do that. But because the bigger a tree gets, the older a tree gets, the greater the value of the actual wood is. Because the bigger a tree gets, the tighter the growth rings are, and the higher value the wood is. So what we say is that those are higher grade trees. But if your accountants are running your business, which typically happens in a corporate forestry situation, what you want to do is you want to cut the trees at their maximum growth rate, convert those trees to dollars, and then grow your dollars. Because in almost any other economy, except for several years back, and now we're entering this again, the best growing ground in Oregon, in the Coast Range, and some of those areas that have the fastest growing forests, you're going to get 4, maybe 5% of growth a year on those trees. That's pretty much the maximum you can get. If you can convert those trees to dollars, you can almost always grow your dollars faster than you can grow trees. And so it's just a game of when you want to cut those trees to maximize the value relative to time. So what's your shortest time frame that you can cut those trees at their maximum value? There's a fancy term for that. It's called a culmination of mean annual increment. And that's a fancy forester word to say that if you imagine the growth rate as sort of a J-shaped growth rate, you know, as the little trees get bigger and bigger and bigger, they grow on a J shape. But then at some point that curve begins to tip and it becomes more of an S. And so they're still increasing, right? They're still growing up, but they're not increasing as fast. And that's where most foresters will cut their timber. So somewhere 40 to 80 years of age, in order to be able to capture the dollars out of that forest and start your next forest that's going to be on that next 40 to 80 year rotation, depending on how good your growing ground is.
Okay. And that's the kind of the generic age I've heard thrown around, about 50 years.
Right. Somewhere right around in there. The farther up you go, the worse the growing conditions. You know, you're looking at 80-year rotations out of the Coast Range. In some cases, you can get, 30, 40-year rotations. The southern slash pine growers are in many cases on 25-year rotations.
Yeah.
And by rotation, I mean, you plant the trees, you cut them, you plant them, you cut them. That's a rotation.
And another thing I've heard about Douglas fir in particular, and it may be other trees as well, I don't know. I just heard it about Douglas fir. Is that a growing Douglas fir takes a lot of water growing up until it's, let's say, an adult. An adult is like at 70, let's say. Yeah. And it takes almost over its share of water. It's almost like a water hog until it gets to that age. And then after that age, when it's an adult, 70 and above, it starts not taking as much water, but instead returning more water back to the forest and catching more water.
Yes.
So if we cut it down before it's 70, it hasn't had a chance to help us out at all.
That's right. That's right. And not only that, but, and I'll get back to that in a minute because you bring up an excellent point, but not only that, but if you look at the diversity of a plantation, it's very low.
Yeah.
Especially when those canopies close because they shade out anything in the understory. So as those trees are growing, you're absolutely right. There was a really important study that that was published in 2017 by Perry and Jones, two researchers from OSU. And they looked at some studies that were set up 50 to 60, almost 70 years ago now, where foresters were interested in how plantations were different from old growth forests. Mm-hmm. So they did what they call paired watershed studies. There's one of them on the South Umpqua and several of them around the Pacific Northwest, where they take two very similar watersheds. They clear cut one and they left the other one in its original old growth form. And then they go to the streams at the bottoms of those watersheds and put in weirs so they could measure the water volume. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that 50 to 60 years after the one watershed has been clear cut, it's only providing about half of the volume of water that the old growth stands are. Okay. And it is true that these young, vigorously growing stands of Douglas fir are pumping a lot of water out into the atmosphere through a process called transpiration. It's the method that the trees use to draw water up from the soil and into their twigs and needles that are the actively growing parts of the tree. Now, as those young forests are growing, right? We've stacked in, you know, lots and, you know, far more trees that can possibly ever mature. So so all the water that those guys are pumping out, we will just cut those guys down and just drop them on the forest floor.
Right.
Increasing fire risk dramatically, by the way, because now you've have all this fuel drying on the ground. For 3 to 5 years, it's a really dangerous time as that fuel is sitting there on the forest floor. And then in the commercial thin after that. So all those trees that have been growing there are just pumping water out all the time, whereas old growth forests are much more water efficient. And not only that, but they store water better. When it does rain, it doesn't run off as easily. It stays in those deep, heavy soils that are built up by centuries of growth. And so they are storing more of that water and then releasing it over time. And so you see that midsummer flows coming out of plantations, as I mentioned before, half the volume of this slow release water. And you also mentioned something else really important, and that is something that that foresters didn't really understand until the last couple of decades. And that is and this is especially true in the coastal forests, less so in the dry forest, but still significant. The idea that these trees cool down at night, and then as warm, moist air currents come in off the Pacific, that water will condense on their needles and twigs and actually pull water out of the atmosphere as it condenses on their needles and twigs, and that drops to the forest floor. So they essentially create their own rainfall. Plantations do very little of that. As I mentioned before, plantations, it takes somewhere around, 100 years to begin to develop the diversity of epiphytic organisms, that is, critters that grow on the trees and on the branches of the trees, the lichens and the mosses and so on, all the critters that live in the lichens and mosses, all the critters that eat the critters that live in the lichens and mosses, right? And so you wind up generating biodiversity as that structure gets more and more diverse. There's an old adage in ecology that diversity begets diversity. So the more structural diversity you have, the more biotic diversity you have, the more different kinds of things that live there, the more things that are going to eat the things that live there and parasitize the things that live there and grow on the things that live there. So the diversity when a forest is clear cut, that diversity, obviously drops, but then there's a whole flush of new growth that happens, all the shrubs and the herbs and grasses and stuff that grow. So diversity goes up.
Right.
Oftentimes, unfortunately, it's exotic diversity. It's all the weeds that blow in.
Right.
But then what happens, as soon as that canopy closes, diversity crashes again. And it takes about 150 years on average in a northwestern old growth forest for you to begin to approach the diversity again that you had when you cut that initial primary forest. If you keep cutting on short rotations, you never get that diversity back.
And why do people care? I keep asking everybody I talk to, why do we care about diversity? Isn't it easier to manage if we don't have so much we have to be looking at?
Sure, sure. And in most cases, foresters don't care about diversity. The only reason that that they care about diversity is when they're forced to care about diversity. So if there are environmental laws, if Oregon Forest Practices Act and so on require certain buffers around streams, they require the federal forest, you're required to survey for rare species ahead of time. In private land, you're not. So there's a famous quote from I'm going to get it almost right. I think from the middle of the last century, a famous forest ecologist that had originally worked for the Forest Service named Aldo Leopold, and his quote was, "The sign of intelligent tinkering is to keep all the pieces."
Right.
And so we don't know. Let me give you a quick example here. Until several decades ago now, there's a kind of a shrub that genus of shrub, there's a handful of species that tend to come in after forest fires because they're fire stimulated. Their seeds have a waxy coating on them. And when the fire comes through, it heats them up and allows them to absorb water and germinate. They're called Ceanothus is the genus. And there are various buck brushes and deer brush and slickwood and various other common names for them. And it turns out that typically they are sprayed out. They are, they're herbicided because they compete with the young seedlings. Right. But like plants in the pea family, the legumes, they have a different kind of a mutualistic organism, a plant partner that lives on their roots in the soil that fixes nitrogen out of the air. So nitrogen is a limiting nutrient in most ecosystems. And yet these plants are able to capture it out of the atmosphere, pump it into the soil. And that is now available for the growing forest, right? And so there's some diversity that we used to think it did was compete with our seedlings. And now what we realize is that those are facilitating the growth of the next forest. So, there's just a quick example. Another example is snags. Foresters hate snags because if lightning strikes them, they'll burn at the top and they'll spread sparks around and stuff. And yeah, that's a dangerous situation. And if you have a burning snag, you should fall it. But they want to fall all the snags ahead of time. A snag ahead for time, most people, if most people know that a snag is a dead standing tree. That's the slang that we use for that. And so who uses snags? Lots of different kinds of organisms, but particularly cavity nesting birds, woodpeckers, flickers, those kinds of birds, right? And then after they bore a hole in the tree and nest, they make a new one. And then the second cavity nesters, chickadees and nuthatches and those kind of birds will move in, right? And so what are all those birds eating? They're eating insects. What are insects eating? They're eating trees. And so by taking out those snags, you're taking out the habitat for the birds who will be eating the insects to keep insect outbreaks from happening in your forest.
Right.
So complexity is extremely important for the overall health of forests. If you just have a monoculture stand of, Douglas fir, and you wind up getting a pest outbreak in there, there's nothing to stop that outbreak because you've taken away all the habitat for the natural enemies of those pest insects. So now you have to treat with, pesticides or herbicides or, you're constantly spraying more chemicals on these trees. You put fertilizer on it because you've taken out the ceanothus. You put herbicide, you know. And so, again, diversity begets diversity. And a more diverse ecosystem is a more stable ecosystem. Disturbance agents, especially in the case of insects and disease, are much less likely to be able to rip through a stand if there's lots of different kinds of trees, lots of different heights, lots of different shapes of those trees.
It's almost as if the system knew what it was doing intelligently.
Yeah, well, I often say, you know, what did these poor forests do before we European foresters ever showed up to do modern silviculture?
Right. Well, no, but honestly, when the Native Americans maintained their forests, if they did maintain them, what did happen if a fire came through or a storm came through and took down or destroyed a bunch of trees or incapacitated a bunch of trees?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Native folks did manage actively, and they used fire because stone axes weren't going to clear anything.
Right, right.
And so in order to keep their roads open along the ridges, they burned off the ridges to keep their camps open and growing all of the species of plants that they use for food and for fiber and for medicine. Those trees weren't growing in closed canopy forests, right? Uh-huh. They were growing in very open, diverse forests. And so the fact that that Native folks burned on a regular systematic basis, in some cases every year, in some cases every 5 years or so, a lightning strike was no big deal. Because they had cleaned up the area. So fine fuels that would carry fires along the surface were very unlikely to hurt anybody. There's a famous passage that was written by the Wilkes Expedition that was going down through southwestern Oregon, passed through this area. We have pencil sketches from 1841 of what the landscape here looked like. And it was very open, lots of rolling open meadows and savannas. But they talked about coming upon an Indian woman who was blowing on a brand to set fire to the forest, probably. Uh-huh. And we stopped, but she was sullen and dogged and made no reply. And so we pressed on. The forest was on fire in several places. We had to pick our way through the forest. So that's, you know, if there was a forest fire, you know, you get the hell out these days, right? You know, you're going to die if you go. But but they had to wend their way through this burning forest to make it all the way down to the Siskiyous, which is where they were headed, and then eventually over the pass into California. And so the fact that these folks were burning all the time, that managed, you know, that kept their fire danger down. But that's not the only reason they did it. They did it because open areas produced camas and biscuit root and, you know, wild iris for fiber and all the kinds of plants that they needed for their daily lives, and also created plenty of forage for the animals that they hunted. And so if you keep the area around you all managed and nice and grassy, you know, the animals come to you. You don't necessarily have to go traipsing off, you know, miles through the woods to find deer. You just set the table, bring the deer to you, and the harvest is much easier.
Okay. So when we are talking about salvage, do you salvage after a fire, for instance?
Yeah. Again, you have to get them early, because you know, past 2 or 3 years, the rot starts moving in. And even though there's still a lot of good wood in the centers of the trees for you know, a number of years, you're hauling a bunch of volume out of the woods that you can't use. And so it becomes economically less and less and less valuable. And so it turns out that, again, we think that, we need to salvage because, number one, we need to get the fuel out. Well, number one, we need to capture the value. But from an ecological standpoint, the misconception is we need to get that fuel out of the forest so we don't have more fires. And then thirdly, we need to get in and replant because those forests won't replant themselves in as short a time as we can do it. And so it turns out, though, that studies that were done, there were two really important studies that were done right close by here in the Siskiyous. There was a fire, 150,000 acre fire in 1987 called the Silver Fire in the Siskiyou Forest, just to the south of us. And then part of that reburned in the Biscuit Fire that burned in 2002. So researchers went back and looked and said, okay, let's look at the areas that were salvaged and look at the areas that were not salvaged that were burned in the second fire, in the Biscuit Fire. Uh-huh. And what they found was that the plantations that were planted in 87, you know, were now 25 years old, not, mm-hmm. not big enough to harvest, but the fire just completely, you know, vaporized them because they were all in that nice crowded stand. But if you looked at the areas that were not salvaged, the tree density was much lower because there were all these brushy species around them. But as mm-hmm. the fire burned through that area, there were so many of the shrubs were far less flammable than the seedlings themselves. And so there was a much higher survival of the natural seedlings that came in the unsalvaged areas than there were in the salvaged areas. And just the salvage alone, there was another study that was done a couple of years after the Biscuit Fire burned that showed that natural regeneration was higher in the areas that weren't salvaged compared to the ones that were salvaged. And so even though they were salvaged and replanted, the natural forest regeneration in the unsalvaged area was significantly greater. So mm-hmm. there's a couple of misconceptions that we have that unsalvaged forests have more fuel and that they don't regenerate as well. And the thing about it is that, yes, there's a bunch of fuel in those trees, right? So when the small needles and twigs burn, if a crown fire goes through and kills that tree right. and burns up the needles and the small twigs, well, then you have smaller branches. And maybe a year later, 2 years, you know, they're going to start to drop out. And then the bigger branches right. start to drop out. Whereas if you salvage that, all that slash goes on the ground right now. And so right. you create much more fuel if you salvage than if you leave those trees out there. And so both from a fire risk perspective and from a tree regeneration perspective, the studies on these naturally occurring experiments showed that natural regeneration and, you know, naturally regenerating forests are more resistant to fire that might come through secondarily. There was another great serendipitous study that was done when the Silver Fire burned in 87. Before the fire burned in there, researchers from OSU, production foresters, clear-cut a whole slope. And then what they did was they created control blocks. And they said, okay, we want to test herbicide A, herbicide B, and herbicide mm-hmm. C. But in order to really know how they're doing, we need to have control blocks, right? So they planted 10 by 10, this whole slope, and they herbicided this with this one, and they did another herbicide treatment here, another herbicide, and then they left the control blocks scattered around. And so they wrote up their study and went away. And yes, indeed, stocking levels were significantly higher in the herbicide treatments. Well, when the fire hit that slope and ran up that slope, the only conifers that were left were in the control blocks because they were surrounded by brush with a lot more water in their leaves and very little resin. And so conifers, of course, are very flammable even when they're right. green because they have so much resin in their needles.
Right.
And these, you know, vine maple and ocean spray and some of the ceanotheses and those sorts of things, you know, have a lot more water in their leaves. And so as the fire came through and heated up those leaves, just like when your sweat turns into water vapor, it cools right. you down, right? And so when the water was evaporating out of the leaves, it was actually pulling heat out of the fire.
Uh-huh.
And so the only surviving conifers were in the control blocks because they were protected by these brushy species.
Now, those control blocks, did they plant those trees in the control yes. blocks, or those were natural?
Yeah, no, they were all planted because they okay. wanted to be able to compare a plantation that was herbicided versus one that wasn't. So, yeah, so those trees were, but their survival rate was much lower because the competing vegetation You know, some of them survived and some of them didn't. So the stocking levels were much lower. And so foresters were interested in how can we get the maximum amount of trees on an acre of ground, because we want lumber down the line. And so so it was seen as, you know, a great success that these herbicided stands had much higher stocking levels than the control blocks, because even though they planted as many trees, there was more mortality, that there wasn't as much survivorship in the control blocks, but those were the trees that ultimately survived the silver fire.
Because it didn't have the herbicides that killed off the brush and the other plants that came in.
Right.
And the brush basically protected them in the end. Yeah.
It did.
Oh, interesting. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, for thousands of years, you know, humankind thought the earth was flat. Everybody can see that, right? You look out your window, the earth is flat, right? And it wasn't until we started circumnavigating the globe and looking at the star, you know, how the stars were changing and stuff, where people finally realized, oh, geez, you know, the earth is not flat. And so we're up against that kind of thing now. The sort of conventional wisdom is that, you know, if you don't salvage, well, first of all, there's no question you're not going to capture that the value in the lumber, but they're going to be more fire resistant, and you're going to have better regeneration if you just leave them alone. So I totally understand the idea that on our federal forests here, Part of the value of those forests when they're logged goes to the county to support county services, right? But there are a lot more ways to make money off of federal forests besides just making lumber. And, you know, there are a whole suite of alternative forest products, as they're called, that can be harvested on a sustainable basis and brought to market. Now, obviously, they're not going to generate, you know, the very large amounts of money that timber does, but they're still going to, you know, there's still going to be value that we can capture from those forests. And what is coming down the line, and sooner or later, you know, every time we, you know, there's some other natural disaster and people finally get their heads around the fact that we've got to control the gases in the atmosphere if we're going to have a livable planet. Here we have these massive, massive storehouses of carbon that are valuable to the world, not just to the people that live in Douglas County. Right. And so are the people that are going to harvest them and, you know, turn them into lumber to sell them across the country and across the world. But there is an enormous value in not only maintaining the stores of carbon that we already have, but packing more carbon in as those trees grow and photosynthesize. Because most of us, remember from our school classes that photosynthesizing organisms capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and convert it to biomass, which can be stored for, you know, years, decades, centuries, depending on the age of the plant that has originally captured that. And we used to think that old growth forests were steady state. We used to think that once a forest reached its maturity age, and that as much stuff was dying as was growing, we just always assumed that, oh, those are steady state. They're releasing carbon dioxide as the woody material decays, because the bacteria and the fungi and the critters that are decomposing those trees exhale CO2 just like we do, right? And so we always thought that there was as much carbon dioxide being released as was being captured. But finally we got up there with canopy cranes and did some sophisticated work and found that old growth forests are indeed continuing to sequester more carbon. And there's another specious argument out there that, oh, we need to get rid of those decadent old growth forests that are just at steady state. They're not capturing carbon anymore. They're just giving off as much as they're. Well, number one, we know that's wrong now. But number two, they say we plant these young, even aged, you know, vigorous plantations, and they're going to capture a lot more carbon as they grow. But it turns out that idea was debunked back in the late 90s by researchers up at OSU who looked at all of the costs, all of the carbon produced, the carbon dioxide produced, logging the forest, yarding the wood, limbing the material, burning the slash, hauling to the mill, cutting stuff up in the mill, putting it into houses that typically last about 100 years, but all the decks and the fences and wood chips and all the other stuff, decompose in much shorter time. It takes, if you cut an old growth forest and you replant it or allow it to naturally regenerate, it takes about 150 years to get back to zero, to get back to where you were before you start, before you make up for the carbon you lost and start capturing carbon again. And so this idea that if we just, cut these decadent old growth forests that are just sitting out there rotting, is phrases that you hear people using, these overmature forests, decadent forests, these useless forests out there. They're not doing any good for anybody. And you replace them with young, vigorous plantations, you can capture more carbon. And that has now been shown, a couple of decades ago, was shown to be absolutely false. The best way you can keep carbon on the landscape and keep capturing more carbon is to maintain those older forests that not only are storing a tremendous amount of carbon, but are capturing a tremendous amount of carbon. We store more carbon on our landscape here than any forest in the world. Everybody thinks that tropical rainforests do. And if you just look at the above ground carbon, there are many tropical forests that have more carbon above the ground than an old growth forest in the Pacific Northwest. But if you look at the carbon that's stored below ground, we win big. And so these are for storing carbon, there are no forests in the world that can match the old growth forests of the Pacific Northwest.
Wow. So that's for a fire. What if you have a storm come through? Should you salvage after a storm? Or is there not enough there to worry about?
Yeah, again, the only storm large enough, the only event that I can remember in my lifetime anyway, large enough to warrant salvage was in 96, we had a fairly massive, what they call a snowdown, where the ground had thawed in mid-March maybe, and then we got a late heavy snow that, if I'm remembering right, between 3,500 and 4,500 feet. Forests were just, a lot of wood came down.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, by far the most wood came down in plantations than forests. So the plantations busted up a lot more easily and came down.
Okay.
And so that created what's referred to as a double disturbance, because that the next year in the Boulder Creek wilderness, there was a fire that came through. And typically, I'm saying, primary forests are much more resilient. Well, a lot of older forests burned for two reasons. One, because they were forests that had grown up that weren't technical old growth forests. They were mature forests, but they had come up after Indians had stopped burning that area in the late 1800s. Uh-huh. So they were like 100-year-old forests, 120-year-old forests. And so they were all even aged anyway, right? They were like giant plantations. And then you had all this down wood underneath them that created a radiated heat up off the forest floor. And even trees where the crowns didn't actually catch fire were killed because of the heat from all this wood on the ground radiating up into the canopy and killing the canopy. So it was a double disturbance. You had the snow down and then you had a fire on top of that. And those can be, those can be really difficult. Typically, had we not had a fire for 3 or 4 years, we would not have had anywhere near the mortality out there. Once those fires, got up into areas that weren't affected by blowdown, snowdown, they pretty much underburned and created the kind of patchy, mosaic-y fires that were typical of this area. When fires came through this area, they rarely crowned, or they would crown late in the day when it was 100 degrees and the wind was blowing 30 miles an hour and the humidity was very low. But the other 22 hours of the day, you know, they were creeping around in the understories and maybe burning out a small patch here and there and creating the, again, this structural diversity across the landscape that allows open patches for, you know, certain shrubs that produce certain flowers that particular butterflies prefer, or birds nest in them, or that sort of thing. And so right. creating these patchy, you know, landscapes where, you know, where some trees, you know, would die when a fire came through, but most of them would survive. That's typical of how forests burned here in the interior forests. And truly most of the forests, we used to think that the Coast Range, because it was so moist for so long that it took maybe 100 or 200 year event in order to dry the forest out enough for them to burn, and then they would burn down. New research out of OSU has shown that that is absolutely not true, that in moist forest and dry forest burned on very short time intervals, 10, 20 years, sometimes 2 or 3 years. But the overstories survive because the more frequently the fire burns, the less fuel there is to be able to produce hot enough fires to get up into the crowns and burn the crowns. So these low intensity ground fires actually created a lot more diversity in the forests, and then ultimately improved the resilience of those forest to fire, because the fuels got taken down to a low level on a regular basis, and what, you know, wasn't allowed to build up as much.
All right. So is there a compromise? We have a fire. Let's go with a fire again. If a fire comes through, is it don't salvage, salvage everything? Is there a compromise? Is there a way to work at it selectively?
You know, unfortunately, we're locked into this situation where our county and the, you know, and many of the counties in the Pacific Northwest, Douglas County has the fourth lowest tax base of the 36 Oregon counties. The other three that are lower are Josephine, Curry, and Jackson counties. The counties that are timber dependent. And so we have created a dependency
right.
on public timber that we're now sort of straitjacketed, because we have among, you know, we pay among the lowest taxes in the country. And nobody wants to hear that we should tax ourselves more, but
right.
you know, we should look at the rest of the country and the kind of taxes they're paying and kind of get close to those. So we're not as dependent on having to log in order to make that money. Here's another thing from the industry standpoint. You know, the industry has no corporate interest in Douglas County getting tax money. They're only interested in getting their shareholders dividends, right? And so it turns out that about half the timberland in Oregon is owned by the public and half is owned by private industry. It's like 48% acre-wise is industry, 52% is owned by the people of the United States. Well, it turns out that the industry owns all the best growing land, and we taxpayers own the worst. And we own the rock and ice, right? Up right. in the mountains. And we you know, the stuff where, you know, sometimes you see, you know, trees 6 inches in diameter, they're 80 right. years old. So industry already controls at least 70% of the productivity of the timberlands in Oregon. They should be able to make a fine profit on the ground that they already have. If they're doing sustainable forestry, as they claim to be, they don't need public timber, okay? The only reason public timber needs to be cut is because we are addicted to timber receipts that we get from the government when we cut government timber.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, you know, we really need to explore ways to for the federal forests to be able to be. To be able to capture the value of those standing forests, rather than always thinking about them as lumber waiting to be milled. So that's the challenge going forward. And to answer your question, in most cases, I would say no salvage. along roads in areas where there are dangers and power line, right. I don't know, you know, places. I mean, there are certainly, you know, probably a few percent of the landscape, you know, would need to be cut, and those trees could be salvaged, or those large logs could be used for structure in streams to improve salmon habitat. So the healthier our forests are, the healthier our salmon runs are, the more money the fishermen make off the coast of Oregon. So there are all kinds of tentacles. What is the value of that forest to Douglas County, to the region, and to the world? And so we need to capture the, you know, ecological service that we're providing to the region and to the world, rather than just focus on turning, you know, trees into 2x4s. Is that's the only way we can fund our county services?
Right.
You know, and let me also say that in a situation, you know, a good half of the federal forests here, and I can't get those numbers. I'm having a hard time getting those numbers from the agencies. But, you know, somewhere 40 to 50% of our federal forests have already been logged and turned into right. plantations. And so there's a lot of wood that can come out of those plantations as we reconfigure those forests into more resilient forests. We need to make very patchy cuts. We can have small openings to support various types of wildlife. We can have clumps of trees. We can have thinned out trees. We can have scattered trees across the landscape. And indeed, the bulk of the timber that's coming off of federal lands now is from thinning from the plantations that we put in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s as they mature. And so if we can go in and do those pre-commercial thins, but instead of grid thinning them, you know, where every tree is now nice and evenly spaced because we want better growth, right. If we can thin them in a variable pattern that mimics a natural forest, a naturally regenerated forest, we can accelerate the structure necessary to support all of the threatened and endangered species that the American people demand we protect, you know, under the Endangered Species Act that was passed in the early 1970s. Right. So on federal land, there is very little reason to salvage primary forest, to salvage forest that we never planted. Okay, right. We talk about harvest a lot, right? You don't harvest something you didn't plant.
Right? Right. Yeah, right. Right.
So all of the managed forest out there, the forest that has already been managed on federal lands, I'm very willing to talk about how to manage those to get some lumber out of those forests while we're improving the, right. the structure and function of those forests. So it doesn't have to be either or, right? It's how and where you log, not whether to log, right?
Right.
And so under what circumstances, what are your objectives? What are you trying to do here? And if it's improving fire resiliency and increasing biodiversity, we know how to do that.
Is there anybody now who's doing this uneven pattern of thinning?
There are some small private holders that are doing that. And when I say, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes, I think I tried to be precise when I was saying yeah. industrial forestry, corporate forestry, that sort of thing, right? The large shareholder owned companies and large, you know, privately owned, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres forests. But there are lots of mom and pops out there that own 600, 800 acres, right. 1,000 acres, you know, that are doing that. And I help manage a forest in southern Douglas County that's a 380-acre forest. And it's very diverse from the start. There are still some meadows there. And there are places where there are massive hardwoods that are now being completely choked out by young conifer timber because these old hardwoods, the oaks and madrones in particular, are fire adapted. Mm-hmm. And the large yeah. pines, the large ponderosa pines as well. And so they thrived in areas that were burned on a regular basis. And so those lands were burned for thousands of years by the local indigenous folks, and then burned for another 150 years by mm-hmm. the ranchers in them. And so our property now, we have, you know, we have 4 or 5 foot diameter oaks and a 6 foot diameter madrone and giants because they never had any value. We have four and 5 foot giant Doug fir stumps on the property because they were valuable. And so pretty much by the time the ranch went bankrupt at the end of the 60s, they had cut every stick of timber that had any value. But then the ranch was left completely unmanaged for the next 50 years until we got it. So now what we're having to do is go back in and thin the conifers that are choking out these centuries old oak trees and madrone trees, which are supplying a tremendous amount of resources for dozens of other species. All the acorns that are produced by the oaks in particular, the oaks support at least 200 other species of organisms that live in them, on them, eat the acorns, eat the things that ate the acorns. Right. And then the madrones produce a massive production of madrone berries at the end of the year, right when migrating birds are coming through the area, right? And so we are doing that on our property, but every tree that we cut because there's an ecological reason to do that. And have we put a bunch of them on log trucks? Hell yeah. You know, we put 250,000, you know, board feet of lumber have gone down the road, you know, from our operation that's allowed us to put more money into our roads, to stormproof our roads, and to create infrastructure on our property. But the management of that property is first and foremost driven by restoration needs. And then the byproduct of that restoration has quite a bit of value. And then what doesn't make specs for the mill gets cut too short, has too much sweep, too many knots. We mill ourselves into lumber that we use. So, you know, we are doing that. But we're a 380 acre forest. And so there are very few companies, very few large corporations that do that kind of forestry, because American business runs sprints. The rest of the world runs marathons, right? And so again, you want to get to the culmination of mean annual increment, cut those trees, make them into dollars, and invest those dollars so that you can grow the dollars. And the trees are just sort of incidental. I mean, the trees are just get you up to a bunch of dollars.
It's just a vehicle.
Continue to grow. It's a vehicle to grow dollars. So it's the objective that you have. If the objective is strictly money, you're going to manage the forest in a, you know, sort of clear-cut plantation rotation situation. And all of the damage that gets done to the soil over the long run, that gets done to the streams that surround that, the public pays for that.
Right.
Industry doesn't pay for that. The people who cause that damage don't pay for that. We taxpayers pay for that. And so we don't do full cost accounting. And so if you added in all the cost associated with clear-cut plantation silviculture, it would not be nearly as lucrative, you know, if industry had to pay for all the downstream problems that the public now pays for.
Ken, this has been a real treat for me. Anytime I could talk to you is a real treat for me. Thank you so much. I've learned so much, and I feel like I'm on a crusade now to go out there and share your wisdom. This has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. We've been speaking with Ken Carlone on the issue of salvage. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you can find past episodes at KQUA. Thank you for listening.